Work session of the House State Affairs Committee to order. It's Thursday, and I guess it's like the 24th. You can tell how this been. If I sound a little raspy, it's because I've got this new, I don't know what it is, bronchial cred that's been going around the Capitol here, so bear with. What we're planning today is to have a work session on the State Affairs Committee bill for adjustments to the retirement system. I think that everybody has become well aware, or starting to become well aware, of the seriousness of this problem, and not only the seriousness of the problem in the retirement system, but also with the interaction of the House and Senate, and how they're this is getting balled up in education funding, municipal assistance funding, and all of those kinds of things, and trying to figure out, is there some way to make the system work better that will not generate new unfunded liabilities in the future? And one thing that I would like to first start off by correcting is it's very easy for people to say we have a $5 billion problem over 25 years. You've seen that in the newspaper, you've seen it you hear it on the air, and that's not correct. And that's what this presentation will show, is we have a $15.6 billion problem over 25 years, and we could solve that problem if we took $5 billion out of our pocket right now, today, cash, invested it, let it grow, and then ate up that, and we could pay that liability off. But it's quite a different thing than to say $5 billion over 25 years, because then it sounds like it's, $250 million a year, big number, manageable, $17 billion a year. The legislature really needs to take a hard look and see, is there any way that we can modify the system and to prevent that kind of unfunded liability in the future? So that's why there's being so much work done on the retirement system now. The retirement system we have is a good system. I have looked deeply into it, and I want to assure everyone that I don't blame the boards for the work that's been done. The legislature is the only one that sets benefits, and we are the ones that are responsible for the changes to the system. So just to make that clear from the beginning, there's no one on this committee that's pointing fingers at other agencies or people and saying you created a problem, or at the employees. Anyway, just to make sure that everybody understands that that's not the problem. The problem is that we have this potential for generating another unfunded liability or additional unfunded liabilities, and that is what is being attempted to control. So with that start, what we'd like to do is, last time I tried to give a quick overview, but it's pretty hard to give a quick overview of a problem and a bill in less than 10 minutes. So we're going to go through the slide presentation that was passed out at the last time. We didn't have it on PowerPoint, but we had it in paper, and so you have those. And if you don't have those and want them in paper form, they are out on the table out in front. There's also a copy of the work draft of the bill. This just is off the press as I speak, so this has not been read across. This is not an official bill introduced into the legislature. This is a work draft, and that is, very unusual for legislators or committees to let out work drafts, because even though we've tried to clean up some of the problems that always take place when you're telling the legal folks what you want and them drafting and not getting things quite right. So the purpose of releasing this work draft is to get with employers, employees, other committees, everyone, so that they can comment on the parts of the bill and the elements of the bill, and we can make changes so that we come out with a retirement system for Alaska that is very beneficial to employees, that is very beneficial to employers, gives them long-term stability, and eliminates the probability that we could have this kind of financial unfunded liability. So that's the, I just want to set those parameters first so that everyone knows this isn't, we're not looking at a blame game or anything like that with this system. What we're trying to do is see if there are modifications of the system that can accomplish those goals. So let's start here with the understanding the PERS and TERS. That's a, yeah, and if anyone wants to move seats or come over in the other seats, this will be up on this wall, and if you can't see it there, feel free to get up and move on over. Remember, this is a work session. If at some time you have a question about an explanation on this, go ahead and just raise your hand out here, and we'll do it. We'll stop in the middle and make sure we clean things up instead of through the end. We won't get into philosophical discussions during this part. I mean, we can have those later, but questions on what's happening. So let's get into a definition of terms here. And the first one, or see how technology works for us. So PERS and TERS, of course, is the Public Employees Retirement System and the Teachers Retirement System in the state of Alaska. And we have two kinds of plans. A defined benefit plan means that the benefits paid to employee are based on a formula set in law. In other words, we say what the benefits will be in some future year, and we try to make calculations to collect money to pay those, but we're responsible to pay those benefits whether we collected the appropriate amount of money to pay for those or not. Under the defined contribution plan, that's a plan in which a member and their employer contribute a fixed dollar amount into the system. Okay, it's kind of like a 401k where you say, okay, you put in 6%, 8%, 10%, whatever percentage the employer and the employee agree on, they match that money and goes into the system, and then that is there exclusively for the use of the employee in the future. And that creates their benefit. So as that grows over time with management, then that will provide the retirement in the retirement amount as well as the medical amount. Actuarial. I was telling everybody a little bit last time that an actuarial is a soothsayer or a fortune teller. They're not a magician. They can't pull magic rabbits out of the hat. What they do is they look at a crystal ball. And what lights are shining on that crystal ball, that's those, that's the baseline assumptions we make. That's what you see in the end. So you have a bunch of statistical models, and you plug in factors. And those factors, we'll go over them in just a minute, but those are things like mortality rate and those kind of things. Past service cost. Past service cost is a payment needed to account to the account. Now this is to amount for the amount of the benefits that were not collected because the adopted assumptions were wrong. In other words, you had the crystal ball, you made the assumptions, this is the amount of money you're going to need for these retiree benefits. Some of the assumptions were wrong, you're going to need more money for those defined benefits, and the money you didn't collect over the past years, it didn't have a chance to grow to pay for those, but that you as the employer or we are the state are still liable to pay. We still have to make those payments. That's called the past service cost. Past service cost rate then is just the rate charged on the total salary for each employer needed to pay that past service cost, and that's calculated over a specific number of years. So when you're talking about past service costs, when you see most of these, well, in fact, all of these graphs have been calculated on a 25-year window. It doesn't have to be a 25-year window. It could be a 20-year window, in which case the rate would be higher because the payments per year would be higher. It could be a 30-year window. At some point, you're collecting money. If you stretch it too long and say, okay, we're going to collect this over the next 50 years, all your retirees are dead. So your collecting not from anybody that ever was in the system. And so that's why this 25-year is in there. People that are still in the system today will still be working tomorrow. They'll be able to pay this into the system over time. Unfunded liability is the actuarial computed payments that would be required to be made for the benefits that were not accounted for in the normal cost rate calculation. Again, normal cost rate calculation means what are the benefits that you're going to have to pay out for what you've promised over the next some number of years, how much money do we have to collect as a rate of the employees pay today to pay for those benefits. And that unfunded liability then is basically equal to the past service cost, except the unfunded liability really comes due when you're having to make those scheduled payments to all the employees, and the past service cost is taking that unfunded liability, spreading it over a certain number of years and figuring out how to collect the money so that you'll have to be able to pay those benefits. So there's a little difference in those two, although they're pretty interchangeable. Present dollar value of the unfunded liability is the amount that we need to be deposited today into a separate account that would grow at a projected interest rate to be able to make the payments over time. Okay, the original deposit and the interest would be totally gone at the end of that time, and that's what we were talking about a few minutes ago. The present dollar cost of our liabilities is about $5.5 billion. So, and you'll hear two different figures. One is generally $5 billion, one is $5.5 or $5.6. And the difference in those figures is that we're working a couple years in the past here, so we've got the 2003 numbers. And just yesterday, the new actuarial definitions came out for this past year, for 2004, and the increased liability, the increased past service costs, the increased amount that we'd have to pay is about, you know, $5.5 billion. It went up about 10%. So those are all in draft form now. They're not set quite in concrete. It's just like this work draft. So we'll have to wait probably another couple of days until after the boards looked over those and found any glitches or any mistakes in calculations, and those are changed, and then that'll be out to the public. So gross normal cost rate means the percentage of salary needed to pay the future benefits. That's the normal cost rate for the for the employee and the employer. So lots of times in these presentations, they've only been focusing on the employer, but the employee is also paying a section of the normal cost rate. So we really have to be careful to specify when we're talking about a normal cost rate. Are we only talking about the employer's section? Are we talking about the gross or the total cost? Then we have the member normal cost rate. We just talked about that. We have the member contribution rate, which is the percentage of salary. And then we have the employer normal cost rate, which is a percentage of salary that the employer contributes towards the employee's projected retirement. So those are normal costs and past service costs, meaning normal cost is your funding for all the benefits you anticipate. Past service cost is your catching up because you didn't collect enough to pay for the benefits that we are constitutionally obligated to pay to the employees in the system that we created. Okay, so sometimes it's beneficial to get through some of these. Actuarial computed rate is a percentage of salary calculated. So this would be both the normal cost rate and the past service cost. So when somebody's talking about the normal cost rate, it means what it's going to cost for the benefits that are expected. You add the past service cost onto that, which has been what's been making these tables grow so high, and that's the actuarial computed rate. And then we have a health reimbursement account, which is an employer-paid account that reimburses employees for medical expenses up to the deposited dollar amount. So it's an amount that's deposited by the employer into an employee's separate account that can be used for any medical expenses, and those can only be used by that member. So it's not like there's a group plan in which you're sharing. It's individual health reimbursement account. So moving on here, we have potential and anticipated variables that can create an unfunded liability, additional unfunded liability. Now, this is the whole reason why we're going through this exercise, is because we're worried that there are additional factors that are going to come into play in the next several years that will create an additional unfunded liability in addition to the $15.6 billion that we're talking about now. So the first one of those is mortality rate assumptions. And, you know, what happened? Well, since 1984, we were using the 1984 mortality table. And throughout a decade and a half, we went through and we didn't recognize that. Now, recognize, I mean, we didn't recognize officially. We didn't tell the actuarials to change the assumption that people were living longer. So finally, in 2002, we adopted the 1994 baseline mortality table, and that jumped everybody's retirement lifetime expectancy by 2.5 years. That meant from the period of 84 through 2002, we had not been collecting enough money to fund those addition, all of the employees, an additional 2.5 years of lifespan. So you can see what a huge difference this can make. Right now we're working on the 1994 table. They have a 2000 table that is being set forward to 2004. And how many more years will that be? I think it's about one if we adopt that. Some people have talked about mortality rate. Can we solve this by going back and adopting the 1970 mortality table, which would take about estimated, you know, 6 or 7 years off everybody's lifespan? And hey, guess what? The past service cost goes away. The unfunded liability goes away. It doesn't mean that if those people do live as we really expect them to from our current table, that we're not going to have to make those payments. It just means that we don't recognize those payments. And if we don't recognize those payments, what that means is when they have to do the overall report, the funding of the system, how, what percentage are, have we funded our plan at, instead of being at, you know, 68%, it goes to 40%, it goes to 30%, and pretty soon we're in the dire situation that some other states are in, which haven't collected enough money for their health and their retirement system, and they have, you know, we've got a big problem, but everybody should recognize that comparatively we're in great shape with a lot of the states. And the problem is that I don't think we want to look and say, oh, look how bad they are, so we can be bad too. I think that that's the whole purpose of the exercise, is to make sure that we work for the fiscal responsibility of the state and the employees as well. Some people have characterized this as employer-employee battle. Well, it's really not, because, you know, the state, through contribution municipal revenue sharing and other things, or direct funding of education, we pay a certain amount of money, and there is only a certain amount of money. If we create unfunded liabilities and make $300 million a year payment into the TERS retirement system, how much money is there going to be to fund the education system, for elevating teacher salaries, for doing those kind of things? So these things are all connected. This isn't anti-employee, but there is a balancing act. There's only so much. So mortality rate is a huge one. Medical inflation rate is another. It was 7.5% for years and years, and then in 2002 we went to 12%. That 12% increase made a huge unfunded liability. That's scheduled to be at 12% for 3 years and then decrease by 0.5% a year to 10%. And 10% is our historic rate with the state of Alaska as what our inflation rate has been. And unfortunately, when instead of having 10% for those, you know, through the 90s, we had 7.5%, that meant we were losing 2.5% a year. We weren't collecting 2.5% a year on wages to deposit to let those grow to pay that medical liability. And in fact, that's why, one of the reasons why TERS is, you know, 40% of the liability is in medical. So anyway, there are assumptions, and those are, if we make the wrong ones, we can make huge holes. Automatic cost of living adjustment. The COLA was in 1961 to encourage Alaskans to stay here. It gives a 10% a 10% cost of living adjustment if you live in Alaska. Well, there's just been a court case that said, whoops, you can't do that. What you have to do is anyone living anywhere that has a cost of living that equals or exceeds Anchorage, you have to give them the Alaska cost of living adjustment as well. It's not as if everybody in the system is going to get it, but their Anchorage has had its cost of living relative to the rest of the country coming down over a number of years. So there will probably be a number of retirees that are living in other places around the U.S. or the world that have high cost of livings, and now we'll have to increase their retirement benefits by 10%. That's just an unfunded liability caused by an assumption. That's why it's very, very critical that as we design these plans and look at them, we look at them very carefully. We don't want to throw something together that is going to not be right, because remember, under the constitutional law, whatever we design, the employees that are hired under that system maintain that system throughout their entire retirement history, not only their retirement history, but their employment history with the state of Alaska. So it's very critical that we talk about these things from all sides of the table and figure out what works for the long term. Ad hoc PRPA, that's a post-retirement pension adjustment. And this is the when there has been an increase in the cost of living and when the fund permits, the administrator may increase the benefits to cover the cost of living. Unfortunately, what this means is that whenever there's a little overfunding in the system, shall we call it overfunding? You know, I mean, this is like a sine wave. It's like sometimes you're going to be above, hopefully we're at 100%. Sometimes we're going to be above, sometimes we're going to be below. The ad hoc PRPA can have the effect of saying if you're ever over the 100%, you have to take that amount and distribute it to the employees as additional benefits. So it's a real problem to try to fix a system, to try to bring new money into the system where we say if we make the system healthy, we'll give it away. And so that's something that I want everybody to consider. Other people have other perspectives on that, but that is a challenge. What else is affected or could affect our liability? Retirement incentive program. We had several of them. They increased the unfunded liability. What happened was people projected what benefits would be received and, you know, what the cost was. Turns out that the benefits under none of the RIP programs were ever realized. And part of this can be seen like in the teachers plan, because the idea was to, okay, we have some very expensive teachers in here, let's let them retire early, buy a couple years of the entire system, we'll retire those expensive teachers out, and now we bring in younger, newer employees. But there was no connection between saying, okay, if you let somebody go with 20 years of experience and you're selecting new employees, are you going to hire somebody right out of college without any experience, or are you going to hire the most experienced teacher for your kids? Well, the local decisions has always been they want the best teacher. So the difference between the retiring salary and who you hired on as the best, most experienced teacher wasn't as great as the actuarials had thought. So we did create a, and this, of course, was legislatively adopted. Let's go on to the next one. The rehires. This has been a question, but it has created a liability of the system. The reason it's created a liability to the system was that there's a past service cost. And the employers do not pay the past service cost on any of the rehires. The whole system is calculated on what percentage we need to collect for the normal cost and the past service cost based on the total amount of wages that an employer is paying. But all of a sudden now, we took some of those out. It's like we reduced the workforce. So we had fewer workers we were taxing for the same amount of money, and therefore the rate that we had calculated won't do it. So if there hadn't been a past service cost, then the rehiree provisions would not have created a more unfunded liability. Since there was a past service cost, it did create an unfunded liability. And we have bills in here to extend that or roll it over to change it now. The next is lowering vesting requirements. We had HB 40, I think it's 90 or 91 this year, asking for police and fire to be able to qualify for full medical at 5 years earlier. We haven't collected that money. People want to change benefits at the end when they get out without collecting the money to pay for that benefit over the course of time. That's what is an unfunded liability. And just once again, you see that's legislation impacting. That's decisions that the people have come to us, have asked us, or past legislators say, geez, this would be a good idea to do this. And people looked at it and said, oh, yeah, that'd be a good idea. That'd be a nice benefit, but hadn't accurately looked at the cost and where the money would come from to pay for that benefit. Okay, going on. Okay, go ahead on there, Louis. This is a problem. The system is 69.5 funded, and you know, we are increasing those unfunded liabilities. One of the reasons is, remember what we did was we've got another law that says you can only increase the amount of contributions by 5% a year. The actuarials tell us we need 25% collected in PERS, let's say. And we say, okay, we're down here at 8%, so we can only go 5% up. So all of us, for several years while you're ramping up, you're not collecting the amount needed to pay that past service cost. So that unfunded liability isn't created by there, but it's pushed off into the future. And whenever you push something off, that means you don't have the 8.5% interest gain on the money by collecting it today. That's why the $15 billion problem can be solved with $5 billion today, is because you're talking about the present dollars earning interest over time to work on it. Okay. And then, you know, there's been a lot of questions about, well, isn't this really just the stock market? And so out of the retirement and benefit Mercer's stuff, you can see that if we have a prolonged recession, that's that top dotted line, it could drastically increase rates. The midline is where we are now. That's our base case. But if we had really good growth, it comes down a little, but it doesn't come down very much. And so those are so you can see that by just having good performance in the stock market, we're not going to get there. We just get there a little bit of the way with that. Okay. And it's the same thing for PERS. This is just the way life works. And then here's a real good one. You can see this is the projection of amortizing the past service cost over 25 years. And you see the dark part there is the population increase of 2%. So you see that if there's 2%, we actually go up to that 25, 28 figure, and then we come down. Because as population grows, what's happening is we have a greater wage base, a lot more people, a lot more dollars you're collecting that percentage on. What normally is done throughout all the projections is a 1% population increase. Now, that doesn't mean population of kids out in, you know, in Homer. What it means is the population of employees upon whom you collect their wage, collect the wages and collect that rate. And then if we had no increase in workers, you see it continues to go up. So those are that's where the calculation are made. These are all made on 1%. Right. And this is the same thing for TERS, again showing where the base case is and population. It looks like they've actually, that being straight across there, it looks like they actually must have made the calculation based on 2%, and then you can see where 1% or 0% has an increasing rates. Okay. And the unfunded liability comparison, this is what we were talking about a few minutes ago. The present value versus the total value over 25 years. And we are also going to put together what the real payments are. Because the payments aren't, you know, kind of equally spread over 25 years. What we're trying to do is spread the pain of collecting for that money over 25 years. Most of it's going to be paid out in those 25 years, but the rate of payments and the actual payments that will be made are based on the retirees, how many people retire, whether they live in Alaska or don't live in Alaska. That's 10% right there. If all of the retirees would leave Alaska and not go to some place that had a cost of living over Anchorage, the liability for the system would decrease by 10% overnight. So that's the sensitivity that these portions of the unfunded liability have. Now, nobody's suggesting that we're trying to get employees to leave, just like, you know, the joke around is kind of like, well, we should be passing out cartons of cigarettes when people retire, you know, so that they'll die sooner, and then that solves the problem as well, because the mortality rate that we're collecting for. And those aren't solutions. Those are changes that we wouldn't be able to calculate at this time. And that, again, is, remember, the actuarial is a fortune teller, and our job here is to try to give them the best data and the best assumptions, the most honest assumptions that we possibly can. Otherwise, we'll end up with unfunded liabilities. So, are there any questions on any of those things before we go on? And I'm sorry it took quite so long, but I think that for everybody, as well as everybody out on the LIOs, to understand where House State Affairs is coming from and why we've been having Saturday and here Thursday work sessions when everybody else in the Capitol is deserted. Now you can see why. The actual dollar value of increase in the past service cost payments, that's just to let people see what the payments are going to be. So let's go you should all have a sheet showing the summary of State Affairs PERS TERS bill that goes through the elements. It looks something like this. And Louis, were these sent to the LIOs?
Yeah.
Okay. So the LIOs all have these as well, and that's great. And we are trying to get we got a hard copy to the LIO, and we're trying to get an electronic version available to the LIO. And we'll also, as soon as we can do that, we'll have it posted on my website so that people can go and download the bill, the work draft from my website. And so we should have that up hopefully later today. Changes to the existing tier. I think we'll go through this first instead of just going through page by page in the bill. What are we trying to do with this bill? To the existing tiers, we're basically saying, okay, we're going to equalize the employer and employee contributions. And now, of course, what we're doing is not quite the same as the Senate has done, where it said they're going to be equal. We see if we have TERS and we're talking about 45% employer contribution and 8 3/4 teacher employee, you're talking 53%. If you equally split that, you're talking about 25% of salary. What you're doing is trying to say, you know, to all the teachers, how fast can you leave the state of Alaska? That's my opinion only. I mean, but that's my analysis of it. And so what we've done is we've tried to look for a solution here that would be equitable. And so what we've done is we put a ceiling on that equalization at 13% for PERS and 14% for TERS. So that's a maximum rate that those could go for the employee. And now we've also, trying to get to part of the problem that we had in the past several years, we've put a floor on the employers at 10 and 11%. Now, why have we done that? Well, when times were good and you could look through there and the employer could make a less than 8% contribution into the system, people looking at that should know that that will not fund over any period of time the benefits that are promised. Even though actuarially the data at that time, good stock market results or something, if we say, okay, those stock market results are going to stay this, you know, high 15, 18, 20% every year from now on, if we had the low assumptions on mortality and they had the low assumptions on healthcare escalation of costs, then we could do that. Well, what this is saying is limiting the boards to say, no, you know, when things get that good, employers can afford to pay 11% into the employee retirement plan. It's a stable amount of number. We're not going to take and shift and say, okay, you can go down to 8% and then use that extra money instead of putting it into teacher retirement. You can use it for supporting some other program that then all of a sudden when the rate has to go up, there's a huge shortfall in the funding for education because we've taken and diverted money out of the retirement system into programs. And so, yeah.
Make a comment. In the worst case of this happening, I think it was Chicago, where the city of Chicago simply set the amount of contributions at zero in the early 90s because they had discovered that they could get by with a zero contribution rate. And when the perfect storm hit, they were so already behind and fell into an abyss and now face a problem that they wish they had our problem compared to theirs. But that's a situation where doing the wrong thing, even though it seems like you can get away with it, and what is happening here is a desire to say, times are good, we don't need to contribute this much, but everything that goes up will come down, and if you behave like everything that goes up will stay up, then you will get in trouble, and that's essentially what this corrects.
And then the next thing we do for changes to the existing tier, and of course this change here is based on the, I'm sure you've all gotten the ledge legal analysis that current retirees can pay a different rate than when they were hired at 15 years ago for ongoing benefits. So you can't change their benefits and say, okay, you've accrued those benefits, we've promised you those are what you have. But the rate at which you're going to contribute salary to pay for those benefits isn't necessarily fixed. And they can choose to either do that or they can leave the system at that time if they're vested. And that's a choice. And, you know, there are questions about that. There are questions that there's counter legal opinions. Some legal opinions say once there's a rate been set, it's set forever for 30 years of retirement history. And if you tell somebody that they're hiring today, you're being hired and it's 5% contribution rate, that you can never change that. That was a operating assumption for a number of years. Even though there have been changes to those contribution rates, those have never been challenged in court. And so we don't know where that'll be. I just want to raise that flag that we need to make this makes a change, brings everybody to the table. The employees get to make sure that they have a healthy retirement system by contributing some, but not this 50-50 split. Yes?
Representative, just want to let you know that Representative Kelly and I have requested from legal a revised opinion with regard to that also incorporates components of Sheffield v. APEA, which is another significant case. And as soon as we get that, we'll provide that to the committee.
Oh, great. Well, we really appreciate that. And I just, where we have different places in the bill and numbers that people question on basis on legal basis or this, that, we want to point those out. So, you know, feel free to let us know, too, if there's something that people have a problem with, think there's a legal problem with, or, you know, just have a philosophical problem with. You know, that's what we'll be doing. The preferred drug list. One thing that we don't do now, I've just received a note, so we're informal, but we are on the record. So what they recording secretary needs you to do, if you want to ask a question, just come on up and sit at the table, because if you raise your hand back there, we don't get the name of the person or the question on the record. So appreciate that. Preferred drug list. What we're doing in this bill is requiring all retirees to use the preferred drug list of the provider. Currently, the provider is Aetna. We don't know that it'll be them in the future. All insurance companies that have these kind of plans do have a formulary. The state of Alaska also has a formulary that we've just adopted, a preferred drug list. It was supposed to save $20 million. We haven't fully implemented it, so we saved about $8 million. That's a year. This provision is estimated to save about $6.5 million a year. And the employment, the PERS and TERS boards and the retirement division have been trying to educate employees to use generic drugs. They were using at 37%, and now it's up to 41%. Every 1% that we switch from just stock brand name drugs to generic drugs saves $1 million. There are a number of drugs that there aren't generics for. There's a number that aren't in the formulary. And as you know, in the state formulary, and we'll have to check on Aetna's, if the doctor puts medically necessary on the prescription, that's medical determination that brand name has some other indication, and so it's filled with full payment. But what this does is it allows the employee to, if they want a particular brand of drug for preference reason, they can still do that. It would be that the reimbursement out of the system would be based on the formulary or generic, and they could pay the difference. This does not change any copay amounts or anything else. So if they decided that they wanted a formulary in addition, they would still have their copay, and then that would be in addition to that. And then the other change for existing tiers is the definition of ad hoc PRPAs. It didn't make a lot of sense to me having ad hoc PRPAs, first of all, because how can we, designing a system, expect if the citizens of Alaska generally are going to have to dump a bunch of money into the system to make it healthy and then say, oh, as soon as it's healthy, we're going to increase benefits because you've made it healthy. What's going to happen is we're not going to have people that are willing to tap into the Treasury to solve this huge unfunded liability problem if we say, well, what we're really doing is just making it so we can make transfers and increase of benefits without coming to the legislature. Now, the legislature enacted ad hoc PRPA, so it's not as if the legislature didn't establish this, but it's discretionary. Ad hoc PRPAs are if the cost of living has gone up and if the system can support it. And so what we're doing is we're just changing, we're making sure that the administrator of the system understands that if the system can support it means it's fully funded. Okay. And that's the technical session, which is just gaveling in and saying hello and gaveling out. So we don't have to worry about the bells today. Creating a defined contribution tier. This is a big crux of this bill. Employee contribution is 10% under PERS and 11% under TERS. And that would go into their own account. The employer contribution is equal, 10% under PERS and 11% under TERS. And that's broken down under PERS into 3.5% of that for medical and 1% for health care reimbursement account. And so 5.5 into the retiree's DC account, defined contribution account. And for TERS, that 11% contribution is 3.75 for medical, 1.5 for health reimbursement account, and 7.75 into the DC account. Yes. Heath, come forward. Thanks.
Just wanted to point out to you, Representative Seaton, and I'm sure this was a drafting error, but page 38 of your bill, line 4, I think the 11% is supposed to be 10, because if you look at lines 7 and 9, that's
page 38. Now we have page to find out whether we're in TERS or PERS here.
3935 refers to PERS. I think it's just a drafting error. I just was pointing that out. Just
okay,
to let you
know. Good. Thanks. We'll flag it. And people, there's some little boxes of flags around too. I've given some back there. So grab a flag and put them on anything that you see there and let us know. Remember, this is a work session, and this is what we're here for, so anything you catch is great. Let's see. Okay, so what we've got is basically equivalent contributions in the two system. Now, this makes that the system for PERS is 20% of the base salary, and for TERS, 22% of a teacher's salary would go into the retirement system. And that's quite different than most of the other discussion. And by my analysis and looking at different plans, that's a very, very good system. A system that gives people enough money for real retirement. Sometimes people talk about if you're self-employed, you should be putting 10% of your wages away as a starting place for salary. Well, this is, you're putting 10%, but your employer is matching with 10%. So all of a sudden, that's 20% or 22%. So you're talking about not something that is going to be a marginal retirement system. I think that this is going to be viewed as one of the best defined contribution plans in the country. One of the questions is, why were we willing to say that the employer would pay 11%. Why don't we knock that down to 8 or 5 or what some of the other plans are? And part of the thing is, remember, that what we're trying to do is design a plan that's going to be good for employees and good for employers. Employers need to attract good employees. And 11% is about the historic average, a little less for PERS, a little more for TERS. Of the past 20 years of what employers have been depositing into the retirement system. So employers are able to stand that. I mean, I talked to just about every, I haven't talked to one employer yet that said that if they had stability and they were contributing 11% to employee retirement plan, that was something that they were worried at all about. So I worry when we start talking about trying to squeeze pennies out of the employer contribution rate that we actually go backwards and we get a plan that isn't going to be sufficient for recruiting and retaining employees in the system. And that's you know, just bad all the way around. The next, like I say, if you have questions on any of this stuff, bring come up at any time. Yes, Representative Gatto.
Just to make a comment, when new teachers are hired, the number one issue for a new teacher is salary. After just 3 or 4 or 5 years, the major issue is the retirement plan. And so if we're looking for the best teachers generally will attract them more strongly with a good retirement plan than we will with a better salary. So this really is a great opportunity for us to establish an attractant to get them.
Based and now in, under our, the plan that we've got, we allow a choice by employees of base salary only or the full salary. That's currently what happens is an employee could go out and be receiving additional money for living in the bush, and that can be part of their, you know, a cost of living adjustment, and that can be part of their taxes and can be considered like part of their wages. What we wanted to do is give employees an option of when they came into the system, say, I want my compensation to be the job I'm getting paid for, but I don't want to have to pay 10% on things I'm getting reimbursed for, those kind of things. So what this does, it allows the employee on an individual basis to select one time coming into the system whether they want to use their base salary or their total salary for their retirement contribution basis. Vesting. An employee is immediately vested in both their portion of the DC count and their employers. Now that's excluding the medical and the HRA because those there's some other vesting requirements, and in under federal law you can't do that. I mean, it would disqualify the entire plan if you allowed vesting and taking of those medical benefits. It just isn't allowed. That's section, I think it was section 125 of the IRS code, and we can give anybody that has a question about it the opinions we've gotten on that. And this is quite different than the other plans because we are saying, okay, we're trying to attract employees. We're hiring what we think are the best employees. We're contributing into the system. And yes, it's portable. Will it allow us to use the retirement system as leverage for new employees to say, you got to stay here even if you're unhappy for a certain number of years? I think that, you know, employees that are happy with the system, they don't feel like they're getting squeezed or undermined by the system, are much more likely to stay in the system than to stay in the system because they say, well, unless you stay another couple of years, you can't get anything. That's my opinion, and I'm sure, you know, that's all the bills don't do that, and we'll discuss the differences between the bills in a minute, but maybe you guys can give us some help with that as well. Investment options. The employee may choose between several investment options, and what we're looking at is the same kind of range that is supplemental benefit section now. There's several different managers of the money with several philosophies, and you can choose to have your plan managed by whoever. We do not have a situation we let people come in under this bill and pick stocks, decide to put it all in Enron or in Yahoo. You know, it could have been a great idea, but that's got to be with mad money that you do outside of this system. This system is all going to be allow people to change some of those risks and reward parameters, but they're all within a fiduciary responsibility of money managers that the state has approved, and we presume the board would use the same system as SBS. Rollover from one qualified plan to another. A terminated DC account can be rolled into another qualified plan. We just let them roll the whole thing in, and people can also roll from a previous account into the state account for management. There's not going to be any matching. In other words, if they roll our money from another account into here, it doesn't mean there's no obligation by the state or the employer to match that money that they roll in, but they can put it in their account and it can be managed as a single unit instead of having to have little pieces here and there all over the place. Transfer of employees in an existing tier to a defined tier. combination tier. Now, what we're trying to do is allow employees that are non-vested, once they're vested, they actually have rights, benefits to the retirement system, the defined benefit system right now. We're not saying, okay, once you're vested, you can keep that, and then you can come in and take the rest of your money and put it in your own private account. But if you're not a vested member, and you've been here probably less than 3 years, and want to roll your money into an account that's going to build individually for you at 20% or 22%, those are the rates of contribution by employer and employee, this system allows you to do that. And if we build a good enough plan, I think a number of employees will want to do that. Employees that are planning to come to Alaska and be here 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, something like that, and leave, they want the portability of the plan, if the plan is a good plan. And so people may well decide, you know, I didn't come up here for 30 years. I came up, you know, until we started having kids or whatever. I mean, we all know the story. People do that all the time, and then lots of time they decide, oh, well, they love the place and stay as well. But that's depending on their own personal decision. And so this is kind of unique to this plan because we allow transfers from people. But it's a one-time transfer and for non-vested. State aid to the past service costs. This is the most unique part of this plan. And what it is we are saying that, okay, let's back up for just a minute and talk about past service costs. Remember that an employer must pay the rate for their normal cost and the past service cost for all employees. That's what those rates are based on. What we're trying to do is say, okay, how can we provide relief in the system? And what we're saying is, as people come online in a DC system, the state, this offset account, where we would put money into an account today, building at the 8.25%, we will pick up the difference between your normal cost and the average past service cost for all those new employees. Okay, so that means that for the new employees in a DC plan, the state offset account is going to pick up that amount. Now, what does that amount to? Can we show that slide? Up here. Maybe. Yeah, and if you look at your handout, is it these or do we have a different one?
You have a different one.
We didn't get it up here yet.
Is this one?
Nope. The graph?
Yeah, just a second, we'll get a graph. If you look at this here, okay, yeah, you want to bring those. And make sure everybody, does everybody out there have this one here that looks like this, the graph, and then on the back says aid to communities? Just raise your hand up there Katie, you want to just pass, or somebody will while we're trying to get technology here aligned with the old-fashioned voice. We're just a little lull. Ah, okay. So here we are with the past service cost. The red line is the total past service cost. That's Yeah, it's the total past service cost payments that are going to be made in those years. And what you see is the existing tiers are down below, and then tier four, now that's increasing and increasing. Why? That's increasing because there's new employees being hired all the time, and those new employees over the time between now and 2021 become a much higher and higher percentage of the population of employees. As they become higher percentage, then that's more dollar amount. So the difference between what's being paid for existing tiers and the total up there is tier four, or new employees that are under a defined contribution plan. And those are millions of dollars on the side. So if you look at your this other one that has all the tables on it, you see the front one there, it's got kind of a number circled there at the top, 9 billion, 25 million. That shows the annual payment to the past service costs. That's every year what's actually going to be paid into the system. And that totals $9 billion. And if you look down at the bottom, you can see that the current existing tiers are 1, 2, and 3. And tier 4 is a new defined contribution tier. And that totals the $6.1 billion over time. Now, there's a little difference between what we're doing and the total number. What we're doing is saying that the state will pay for all the new DC members the past service cost up to the average past service cost for all employers. Now, why is that? There are some employers that have made bad decisions. There are employer, and so they have huge past service costs. And I don't mean to pick on Fairbanks, but Fairbanks is a great example. They basically sold off the utility to get the high value for the utility. They retained the liability for retirement. So now they have, I think it's like 87 employees in the system, and they're supporting like 470 retirees. If there wasn't any past service costs, that wouldn't be a problem. Remember, normal service costs means you collect over the lifetime of those people all the benefits. But there is a past service cost, and that's why when they sold the utility, I'm not exactly familiar with that example. The example I'm familiar with is Seward in my district. It had the hospital, it was trying to manage the hospital. It was finally able to sell the hospital to Providence, it happens to be, but Providence said, we'll only buy this and put it in our system and keep the hospital there if you, the city, retain the retirement liability. I mean, you know, what do you do? I mean, so it's not a bad decision. I mean, the hospital's there, the hospital's working and everything else, but there is a huge unfunded liability in the city's coffers. Now, if they had were able to get a large amount of money for it and stuck that away into a little permanent fund, you know, hey, that's good, but what we're saying is, well, you got that large amount of money and you put it away in the permanent fund, and you're going to have to use that money to pay those liabilities above the average employer in the state. We're still going to be picking up a big part. We're going to be picking up the part from the normal service cost to the average of all in the state. But it's just hard to have all the other employers and the people of the state come along and say, you know, you can have $100 million in a permanent fund for selling the asset, and we're going to come out and bail out the liability side. So, again, not meaning to pick on Fairbanks or Seward for that instance. There are good reasons for doing these at the time. It's just that we don't want anybody to think that we're just rewarding bad decisions or rewarding decisions that sometimes weren't bad. Like I say, I don't think sewage was a bad decision. It was the only decision they had to make, but it is a local decision. They may have to raise local revenues, you know, sales tax, those kind of things to pay that off. I digress, but that's often hard for people to understand what that is. So what is the present value? How much money would we have to put into the system? Under this chart, you can see here's the present value. If you look on the right side of the chart, the present value of the payments. The total payments is $2.8 billion. This is in, again, for PERS. You see Tier 4, the total that we would need to deposit today to make all of those payments is $1.660 billion, or $1.66 billion. We would have put in the bank today, let it earn the money, and that would make all these past service cost payments. Again, remember that our number is a little less than that because there are some people that are above the average employer, and we're not picking up that amount. And we can give you that amount in a little while. If you turn the page, two pages over, you'll see that for TERS, the total is $6.6 billion, and the total for a Tier 3 is $4.8 billion. Now, there's no difference between the employers in TERS. In other words, everybody's an average. It was one single system. So it's not two different systems. So that would be the amount there. And if you look over for the total dollar cost, it's $1,292,193 that we'd have to put in now, present dollar costs, to pay that off. So if you look at those two together, you get what we are talking about in the past service cost account, past service cost offset account. And that is the unique picture of this, is because how are we going to aid employers with this huge escalating cost structure, and also give employers some reason for wanting to go to a defined contribution plan? If we came in and said, okay, we're going to take $5.5 billion out of permanent fund, out of somewhere, and solve this problem, if there's no problem, there's no reason to change. And the problem, as we talked about before, has potential for doing this same kind of thing over again with mortality rates, with the assumptions. Those are very much minimized in the defined contribution plan. Every employee has his own account. The medical is a defined dollar amount. There are a few little changes, and we'll get into those, but almost most of the potentials for unfunded liabilities go away. Medical components of the defined contribution tier. These are similar among all the plans. Ours is a little different. A retiree must retire directly from the system to be eligible for medical benefits, and that's either at age 60 with 10 years of service or 30 years of service, period. And the member must be employed in the system a minimum of 12 continuous months before retiring. And in other words, somebody leaves and comes back and takes a job for a month, they can't retire. I mean, they have to be a full-time employee for the 12 continuous months before retiring. Early retirement. A retiree who has satisfied 30 years of service but has not yet reached 30 years will receive access to the medical plan. That means we have this group plan that a person that hasn't reached 60 years can pay the full premium on and can be a part of that plan. But there's no subsidy by the plan. normal retirement is at age 60, whereupon the retiree is granted access to the plan and a subsidy depending upon the years of service. 30% subsidy starts at 10 years of service, and then it goes up 3% additionally for each year of service. This is a little different than some of the other plans where people are talking about. You have these categories. If you've been in there 15 to 20 years, you get a certain amount. As soon as you get a day over 20, between 20 and 25, you get, basically it's 3% a year, but it's in categories. And what we're trying to do is give flexibility for employees to make decisions based on their whole circumstances instead of saying, okay, gee, you got 4 years before you can increase any medical benefits, so I may as well retire now. Or saying, oh, guy, I really want to get out of here, but and I would be willing to stay in the system 2 more years, but I have to stay in 4 more years to get any increase in my medical coverage. This gives an annual thing so that people can make the decisions based on the entirety of their employment experience. And that goes up to a maximum of 90%. And Medicare eligible become medical eligible. Now, age 65 is the current Medicare eligibility. This plan changes and says, doesn't specify 65, and it specifies Medicare eligible. I mean, we could have an unfunded liability created in adoption of this plan. If we say age 65, and now all of a sudden Medicare goes to 67. We have just, by the design of our plan, increased 2 years of basically unfunded liability in the medical component because we're paying the subsidy at a much greater rate until they're medically eligible or Medicare eligible. So, you know, as you look at these plans, employers and employees, please flag for us and make sure you comment on whether you see things that we haven't taken care of. And the health reimbursement account is established in each member, help pay the premiums, co-pays, deductibles, and any other expenses there. And the employee will contribute 1%, and we're working through that so that it guarantees that as you use those dollars, basically you might have a debit card, and whether you went to the acupuncturist or whether you go to the hospital, you give them your card, and it's a debit card, and it takes it right out of the system for any medical expense. That's determined by the employee, but we also assure that you get the lowest rate for those dollars that is available for Aetna. One of the problems with paying cash for medical services is hospitals will charge you 3 times as much because you're one of the people who they use to offset other services. So what we've designed into the plan is that people providing service must provide those HRA, those health care reimbursement, which are cash dollars to them at the time, at the lowest cost available through the system. And so we are trying to make those dollars go farther for individual members. And I guess that's about the wrap up on where we are. We can go through, those are the elements of the bill. There is one other one that I want to bring up, and that is age 60. We have a consideration in here on age 60 as being age 60 as adjusted by adoption of new mortality tables. Okay, so right now we've got age 60, but if we come in and adopt a mortality table that says, oh, we're going to fund you for a year longer of life, that means a year more of health care, year of everything, that could change at age 60 to 61. Just like with the Medicare eligible, instead of tying that 65, tying it there. It makes a few little complications in the system where we'll be waiting for comments from people, you know, on both of those factors. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Very good, although overwhelming. A couple things. I noticed that the mortality tables reflected that in an 18-year span, the longevity went up 2.5 years. And so for that entire 18 years that we were simply paying out, the people were going to live at the end of that 2.5 years longer, which reflected an additional 2.5 years of payouts, which certainly contributed heavily. My my guess is we should probably adjust the longevity of a person's mortality tables maybe once a year or once a month, rather than waiting 18 years, because we got ourselves so far behind. You know, it's possible that the mortality tables could even go in the reverse direction, in which case we would be able to adjust them in either direction. Number two was the RIPS, retirement incentive, for usually for teachers. You take an extreme case where everybody retires and then gets rehired back again. All of those people that are rehired back would contribute zero into the retirement system, but they would all be receiving benefits, and of course that would break the system in just a couple of months. And so while it was a wonderful idea and I supported it myself, there is a difficulty with it, and that is certainly that when you have fewer people paying in but still a constant payout, that the system will self-destruct in a certain number of years, which is entirely predictable. And then maybe the last one, as far as the retirement age, there is some thought to tying the retirement age to the mortality tables, and I believe Representative Seaton addressed that, to say as the mortality of a person increases, instead of fixing the retirement age at 55 or 60, maybe that ought to float with the normal life expectancy. All those things, I'm sure every one of them will be received negatively by people in the plan because it places an additional burden on the members. But if the goal is to make the plan live forever, then certain adjustments have to be made. And naturally, you would expect that the burden falls upon the plan members. We did have some people who gave testimony who said, essentially, here's my pay stub. Look at how little money I'm making each month, and I'm a single mother. And it's difficult not to have compassion for a single mother who presents the pay stub, and the pay stub indicates there's substantial deductions on the stub. One of those deductions, which accounted for a little less than half, was the PERS-TERS contribution. And so if we were to increase that person's contribution by 5 percentage points, that would have resulted in a certain amount of money additional deductions. I don't want to mention amounts because I really don't want to tie it to that one person. But I had this question, and maybe you do too, that if we, as the person suggested, we do not make any changes in order to protect that person, 10 years from now, there'll be another person just like that person who will be in a bankrupt system and have to make enormous contributions. And that second person's question will be, if you've known about this for 10 years, why didn't you do something about it then? And the only answer to that question is, well, actually, we did. And we have to go back now and say, this is that 10 years ago. We're going to do something about that now to protect not only the existing people, but those people who will show up in 10 years and make a very legitimate complaint about how lax we were and standoffish we were about making changes that were essential. I'm a recipient. And so I have an interest in maintaining the integrity of the system, not just for myself, although I think mine is guaranteed because the state can't get out of it. The state is a taxing authority. And if the state went bankrupt or filed for bankruptcy, you could go to court and say, all you've got to do is raise taxes. And besides, you've got $30 billion in the bank. You can't get out of it. So my interest in it is really to save it for other people besides myself and those single mothers and those other people who are married with children in the future who will simply be facing this problem 10 years from now or even next year or 5 years from now to make sure that what we do is something that we do that will help the system to remain solvent. We will all have medical payments to make. It seems like we pay a great deal of money for medical care in our last year of life. When you face that year, it's not the year to say we're going to cut your ability to make those payments. And so I have to say that this is very hard for the committee members and for all members of both this body and the other body to make these draconian, and I don't think they're draconian changes, but they're very important changes. They would be draconian if we didn't do anything about the system. And so my apologies to people who are going to be facing increased costs. It's the only thing we can do to save the house from burning all the way down to nothing. And I hope we have the support of the members in these changes. So with that.
Thank you, Representative Gutto. And just so everybody knows, Representative Wyrock and Representative Ramros are online, and we have a number of staff people here from Representative Gruenberg staff, Representative Kelly staff, and others. So anyway, we really appreciate everybody paying attention to this as well as participating. Let's take a quick look at this chart of comparison of the plans. Does everybody have the one that's two page, that's the front and then the back of the first page and then the third page? They're laterally across and they're being handed out around here now. And in the upper left-hand corner, it's got current PERS tier 1, 2, TERS tier 1, DB for Divine Benefit Plan. And then over at the right-hand side, it's got the current PERS TERS. And then it has a State Affairs DC plan, PERS TERS bill. That's this one we're talking about here. We don't have a number on it yet. And then we look at the Senate Bill 141, which is Defined Contribution, and House Bill 191, which is Rep. Kelly's bill, which is a defined contribution plan. So if we just take a moment to look across there, what's current? PERS employees, police and fire. Let's look at the second column over. There's hardly anybody in tier one anymore. So let's look at that's still paying in the system. 7.5% for police, fire, 9.6% for school districts, and 7.5% for all others. Under this plan, there would be 10% for all in TERS. Under the Senate Bill 141, it would be 8% for all members. And under House Bill 191, it would be 8.5% for police and fire and 8% for all others. That's for a PERS employee. TERS employee is the next line. And we see current at 8.65. Under the DC plan, it would be 11 that we're talking about today. Under the Senate Bill 140, it would be 8%. And under 191, it would be 10%. Vesting. You can see it's 5 years for PERS and 8 years for TERS. Under this plan, employees are immediately vested in both the employer and the employee contribution. Now, in Senate Bill 141, there's immediate for the employee contributions. That means the employee, their percentage, which was 8% that went into the account, they could take out at any time their money. But you only become fully vested in the employer part of the money until after 5 years. In other words, the first year, I think there's nothing from the employer. The second year, you get 25% of the 8%. Third year, you get 50, and then 75, and then 100% of the 8% contribution is invested, and then you're getting this matching employer-employee contribution. Under the House Bill 191, the employee is immediately vested in both the employer and employee But the employer contribution is graduated. It goes up, I'm trying to remember, at 25%, is it?
Yeah.
I think.
Under benefit formula, it just shows the structure there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, down under benefit formula, it shows that. So retirement age, currently it's normal or 55 early. With 20 years for police, fire, 20 years for teacher, and 30 for other, under all three plans that are DC plans, it would be anytime it's your money and you can retire whenever you want. And when you leave the system, then you decide what to do with that money. Under the PERS and TERS benefit formula, the state affairs version there is 20% for PERS, of which 1% goes for the HRA and 3.5% for medical, and for TERS is 22% with 1.5% for the HRA and 3.75% for medical. There's 11.5% in House Bill 141, which includes the 1% for HRA and 3.5% for medical, and then it graduates up at 25% a year. Up to the 16%, which would be the total of 8% for the employer and 8% and 8% of employee contribution. So it starts off at 11.5 per year, and then goes up to the 16%. And that's like House Bill 191 is 16% after 5 years of service, and that's that percentage contribution as it goes. If we look down at the medical components, they're very similar. However, the only one, House Bill 141 and 191, there's no medical component until you're 65 years with 10 years in service, or I think that they're will be looking at changing that to Medicare eligible age as well. Otherwise, we don't have flexibility in the system to respond when the federal government makes changes. Under state affairs, you must retire from the system. And at 60, you become eligible for some. And if you go over to the next page, it shows you those medical benefits and how the contributions are calculated. Or what the benefits are. The next line, employer normal cost rates for PERS and TERS is 10% for PERS. Under the state affairs, it's 8.25% under 141, and it's 8% under House Bill 191. And then for the employer normal cost rate for TERS, 11% under this one, 8.25 or 8.75 under the other two provisions. And risk, of course, employer risk is minimal under all three, and the employer bears the investment risk. However, that investment risk is somewhat ameliorated by the choices that the board allows the employee to make with the money. So it's not as if it can go out, you can go about and buy gold or art or something else. It's within these others. The base salary, the employee option under state affairs plan is for base salary or total salary. We're not sure what that is under 141, how that, it says the contributions, compensation. And so there hasn't been the discussion to find out whether that means the base compensation or total compensation in 141, and then the base salary only in 191. So there's an option for the employee under the state affairs version to take that. Rollover is accepted from a qualified plan in the state affairs version and in 141, and 191 does not accept rollover contributions. However, you can roll over in 191 to your stuff in your plan to another plan. Let's see, investment options. We have, under the state affairs version, ASPIB manages the investments. Under 141, the participant controls the investments. And there'll be a range of options set by the new board structure that that creates. Remember, 141 is combining the Alaska State Pension Investment Board with the PERS board and the TERS board. And it'll be managed similar. I presume that, their selections would be the same kind of and similar selections that we would require under our plan, which is basically the SBS model. And then in 191, ASPIB continues to manage. The financial aid to the system, here's the biggie. Past service cost offset account, $2.681 billion deposit is required, and that will be what contributes and pays those employer costs on all the new defined contribution employees over time. 141 has $69.5 million from the state to compensate for a 5% increase in employer costs for 05-06. And the there's no state aid to the system under 191. And then transfer of employee to a DC plan, the state affairs version is the only one that allows non-vested current employees in tier two or tier three to come over within 90 days of enacting the legislation. It's a one-time option for those people that want to do it. We don't know how many people are going to want to do that. And so all the calculations on the past service cost account and everything are based on all the actuarial models of 1% employment growth and when people are retiring, so they're being replaced, and so there's all kind of knowns. Now, there are some possible glitches in there. Maybe their retirees won't occur as fast as the actuarials have said, predominantly in TERS, because there was a change in TERS, they had to stay in longer, had to stay in another 5 years to qualify for medical. And Mercer has that pretty much being a straight line, and there may be a real slowdown in exit from TERS for 5 years. What that would mean is we wouldn't need quite as much money in the offset account, because those wouldn't be being replaced with new employees in a defined contribution plan. And that's the way we look at this. Another comment I would like to make is I think that Representative Kelly has Bill 170, which looks at changing the PERS and TERS boards. We see in 141, Senate Bill 141, a combination of all three of those boards. There have been discussions among members, nothing's been decided, but we may well be looking at rolling the PERS and TERS board together. There doesn't seem to be a good reason to have the functions of the boards and the actuaries in two different boards. I think there's pretty much agreement among members that we need to have employee members insured on those board. And we haven't seen at this point the justification for taking the investment board, ASPIB, and rolling that into the kind of hearing officer board and those kind of things that PERS and TERS board does. So this is just a question, and hopefully this will stimulate some comments back to us as to whether that's something that you think should be considered or not. But we've heard in the past that PERS board and TERS board don't really talk together well. The actuarials aren't corresponding well. Those kind of things. So what we'd like to do is make sure that we have a pretty consistent program over time, And so just to make everybody aware, that's not in the bill currently, but we'd like to work with Representative Kelly and see if we can come to some way of not just restructuring the TERS board, restructuring the PERS board, put the two boards together, and, but still have ASPIB do the financial management. We have some concerns of taking financial managers and then rolling them into the other kind of decisions that are being made. Representative Gatto.
I'm okay. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Wyrock, are you online? Would you like to comment?
He dropped off.
He dropped off. Okay. And Representative Ramos, at, is the Fairbanks LIO still on?
Yes, it is. Hi, Representative Seaton, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, how are you doing? Would you like to add anything or bring up some points that we should discuss down here?
Just recognizing that your meetings seem to run more smoothly with me at a remote site, Mr. Chairman, makes me nervous. No, actually, sounds like a terrific presentation, and I just want to applaud you for making good progress on such a complex, sticky issue. I think you're doing an excellent job of disentangling it.
Well, thanks on that, and if anybody, as your as representatives that are out meeting around their constituent bases, I hope you'll talk with people up in your communities up there and your school boards and every or school teachers as well, and bring back some real life opinions there, and feel free, you should have that information in the LIO, and if you could make a few copies and distribute them around up there so we can get comments back on this. I think that people are realizing from the numbers that we were going over earlier this morning is that the problem is more significant than many people have been aware of till now. So thanks for being online. Representative Gatto has a comment for you, I think.
Representative Ramirez?
Yes, sir.
I hope you enjoyed the slide presentation. And I'm curious about your comments about the Fairbanks utility and the action that they took and the result that happened from that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with that. Can you clue me in real quick?
Oh,
no, that's fine. I hope you realize up there in Fairbanks that we weren't knocking Fairbanks. I was also talking about Seward and other places that were in that same fix of having to retain the liabilities and selling the assets, and if you meant that part of the presentation, the past service costs that we would be adopting or the state offset account would pay would be the past service cost up to the average past service costs for all employers, all PERS employers.
Yes, sir. Well, I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that up here in the city of Fairbanks, which is probably at the very, very bottom of 155 municipalities, we have 89 active employees that are supporting 453 retirees because of those kind of movements and decisions in prior years. So it's a tremendous burden on the local municipality that far exceeds the problems that the state of Alaska has. It's going to be a fascinating thing to try and how to keep it, the city of Fairbanks from becoming insolvent, as we solve this problem.
Great. Well, thanks very much for being online here. We do have somebody to testify on Kenai. Melody Douglas, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity for a quick comment here. I just wanted to commend you and your staff and all those who have worked with you in preparing this information for the public, and I'm particularly appreciative of the comparison recap. As you can probably well imagine, there's a lot of information out on this topic, a very weighty one for all those of you working and all of us, those of us out in the field looking to work with you on this through the remaining portion of this session. I particularly want to compliment you and let you know how much I appreciate your diplomacy and your care, Mr. Chairman, in talking about the issues that have brought us to the conversation today. And I am particularly appreciative of the attempt to not be finger-pointing, because there's been much of that along the way, and I think that's detrimental to the conversation. We just need to figure out how to go forward, and I thank you for where we are today.
Thanks, Melody. And if you would, as you get a chance to look over these and look over, I think electronically, or at least by electronically, we did get the bill to all the LIOs, and it's also on my website. If it's not, it will be soon.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, the LIO and the folks there in Juneau have been very good. I've been kept abreast with everything you've passed out today, so thank you.
Great. And let people know that is available. Like I say, it's unusual for a work draft to be circulated. And it's, like I say, the revisions, we've finally gotten to where we think we can have something that people can comment on that doesn't have, a bunch of typos and a bunch of wrong information in it. But as you see those, like Mr. Hilliard pointed out on page 38, that should be 10 instead of 11 on line 4 for PERS contribution. Flag those things for us. Let us know if something doesn't look right. It may be that, it's just in the drafting. This isn't the final, and so let us know. We'd also really be curious of how the district and the employees feel about the level of defined contribution plan at, it being 20 or 22%. Also, we did make a few changes to the medical that was in the Tier 4 situation. Nothing real major, but we made a few changes. So if there's any comments that you can provide us on those, we'd sure be happy to receive them.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I expect to be back to you folks by the first of the week.
Great. Thank you very much, Melody. Is there anybody else online that would like to comment on any of the elements that we have here before us today? Okay. Anybody in the audience? Yes, come on forward, please, and identify yourself. And
again, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Heath Hilliard, Staff Representative Kelly. Just wanted to let you know, in addition to the revised legal opinion that we will be forthcoming, we also have a new version which we would like to offer the committee at the next possible opportunity. Essentially, it's a blank committee substitute with regard to our HB 191 that hopefully the committee would at least entertain adopting for the purposes of discussion as a work draft. So when you have the opportunity to meet again in full committee, we'll be bringing that forward, because I know we didn't have an opportunity to address HB 191 at the last committee, but I do know that the sponsor wanted to extend his appreciation to you for taking the time to consider those bills, and that we look forward to coming back and speaking with you again.
Great, and I don't think there'll be any problems adopting it for a work draft by the committee. I mean, that's what we want to do, is get everybody's best work on the table, and then hopefully everybody will be able to look at the elements and figure out what they need to incorporate in, and whether it's a individual bill or a committee bill that goes forward. But just go from there.
One other question, Mr. Chair, with respect to your discussion about the possibility of doing a state affairs version or a state affairs component of the board fix, a board restructuring, do you anticipate incorporating that into the corpus of your broad bill, or are you looking at perhaps an individual bill on that? I'm curious.
Actually, what I think I'd look at is an individual bill. Hopefully, Representative Kelly would be amenable to doing that. I think that would kind of fix some of the problems that people perceive by the two different boards and the communication. So I know Representative Kelly's bill 170 works at trying to fix some of those board things. I think that there is quite a bit of concern if the board fix doesn't include mandate that you have people from each system there at the table with the understanding of those systems. But I think that his basic framework is a good framework to start from. So if he'd be interested in working with us, I would rather see that go as a separate bill, because I don't think it's integral to the revision of the plan. I think it's something that would be helpful, but like I said, when we had the 170 hearing, nobody has really identified to me where the TERS board or the PERS board has independently come out and done something wrong. You know, they've done they adopted some numbers that didn't turn out to be right, but they did those in conjunction with the legislature. And so I just, you know, don't think that we have boards running amok. We can always improve them. And so and my understanding is that we could maybe get a good piece of improvement by combining the board. So I'd like you guys to look at that as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly's authorized me to speak for him this morning. I think we would be absolutely willing to entertain that notion. And if you would like to have it in a version coming specifically from State Affairs, that would certainly be your option. But I think that Representative Kelly would entertain the notion of allowing you to essentially strip out what he has currently in HB 170 and making the appropriate changes as you suggest as well. I think he's very willing to work with you in any capacity in that.
Oh, good. And that would be my preference, is to have Representative Kelly carry a board fix from the House side, and then we'll have to talk with Senator Stedden and others on the Senate side and see how we can get the best aggregation of the plans.
Great. I think our only intent with respect to the current version of 170 was to make as minor a changes to the existing structures as possible, but still to affect some kind of management change. But I think that putting the two boards together really could make some sense. And so I know that Representative Kelly will talk to you about that when he gets back.
That's great. We'll look forward to doing that. And this also puts everybody out in radio land on notice of what we're thinking about and considering doing, so that they can give Representative Kelly and myself input ahead of time. I mean, if we're going down a rabbit trail, that people can tell us what and why is not a good way to go. We appreciate hearing that before we put a lot of hearing time and everything else into that. So please, on this issue or any other issue, we would hope that you would come forward as soon as possible, instead of just waiting till the end and then saying, well, you really goofed back then, so that we can all talk about something that can be positive for the system. Is there anybody else out there? Yeah, come on forward and identify yourself for the record. And
good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League, and we've had a school district, municipal, university working group working for about 6 months, and Melody Douglas, who just testified, is a very active member of our working group. But as employers, we're all in the same boat, the university, the school districts, municipalities, and the state. The Alaska Municipal League, Alaska Conference of Mayors, have two top priorities for the year. One is a PERS fix, of course, which includes some assistance, but also a reordering of the plan to make more sense for the future, to make sure we don't get back into the same place that we've been in the or that we've gotten to from the past. The points I want to support specifically are some of the major things, and this is very interesting, and it didn't come up today, but it's something I've gotten from past presentations, which I think is really important, is that the Division of Retirement Benefits have testified in the past that actually the health side has gotten us into a whole lot more of the liability problem than the pension side. And so working on the health side, some of the recommendations you have made to bring the health side costs under control are probably, in my opinion, or our opinion, the most important side of the equation in terms of looking at future liability. And within that health liability, other testimony from the division is that 75% of the cost of the health side to the program is in pre-65 costs, meaning that it's three-quarters of the entire cost of the retirement system accrues to providing health benefits to people that are under 65, only 25% of the total system benefits to people over 65, largely because of the Medicaid issue. And so I think in the past, some of the things that have probably been some of the major cost drivers to the deficit have been having a person work 5 years or 10 years maybe working from 1985 to 1991, but then getting full health benefits for the rest of their life in 2005, for example. And so some of the tightening up of the health system that you're proposing, you know, I don't know what the right balance is, but I think that absolutely has to be done to make the system solvent, and is probably the most important part. So that was point number one, and thank you for addressing that side, and that's where I think a lot of the debate should be centered. The second point I want to make, though, which is just a consideration, you know, on the municipal side, school district side, university side, or the state, whenever you take additional money out of employees' take-home pay, it's going to be an issue at the bargaining table. You know, so there's a balance there, you know, and we will hear about that in every municipal government, every school district, and so on. The three things that I wanted to focus on very quickly, and we had a teleconference several days ago with about 15 municipal finance directors, school district folks. Melody was online, and so on. At this point, I think it's real important to start looking at comparisons, you know, because really making sure that a plan is something that will attract and retain good employees is critical. And so we would like to suggest that some good comparison information with other potential employers that would be competing for employees might be looking at would make a lot of sense. And then I think in terms of making employees more comfortable is taking some base cases and saying, you know, person who worked at a normal wage for 25 or 30 years, this is the type of retirement they could look at. I think that would make people a lot more comfortable in figuring out how to evaluate the systems. That's the first point. Two more real briefly. On the pension or the retirement system boards, the one really important fact that we think about all the time is that the PERS and TERS systems are not primarily state government systems. Two-thirds of the people in those systems are in work for municipalities, school districts, and the university. So the state only has about one-third, a little over one-third of the employees. And so in developing the structure for the board, one of the recommendations that we make and we feel is absolutely critical is employers are not represented except for the state, I guess. Some way of getting direct municipal, direct school district, direct university representation on there, well, it's for accountability, if nothing else. We will never be able to say the system was a black box, which frankly it probably was, and it always used to seem to give pretty good results, and so nobody tried to open the top and look at what was inside. You know, there's just no incentive to do that, and it was very difficult to do. But having direct representation by municipalities, school districts, and the university on the board, they're paying part of the freight, obviously. They have a great interest in making sure that those decisions make sense now and in the future. And actually, some of the best comments I think you'll hear are going to be from municipal finance directors, school district business officials, and so on. And then the last point I wanted to make, and this is not in the current bill, but if you go back to page 10, that graph that you generated, and for people in the audience, that's the unfunded liability comparison. One of the things that our group has been talking about, and I think you may have heard from some folks about the possibility of pension bonds. The possible advantage of pension bonds is that total value over 25 years of $16 billion is predicated upon 8.25% increases in that liability over time. If a pension bond that was either, say, 5.5% or 6% was purchased, it'd be interesting to see what it would do to that value of the unfunded liability over 25 years. And it may be possible to do that, but it may not be possible for municipalities, school districts, and the university to access that without specific state help. In terms of setting up as either a function of the pension board or a function of the municipal bond bank, setting up the ability to it's not technically a bond, and boy, I don't want to get into the technical parts, but the bottom line is that a municipality cannot do a general obligation bond for pension benefits. It's unconstitutional. However, our pension liability with this program is as stringent as a bond. You can't get out of that liability. So the possibility of doing a pension bond, if it could, say, reduce the liability for the state and municipalities of maybe 25% and looking at what those possible savings might be over time, could be very, very valuable.
Do you think it's too generous to
assume? Representative Gatto?
Thank you. Do you think it's too generous to assume 8.25% return? I mean, we've seen the market kind of declining now for weeks after a significant rise.
Oh, through the chair. The 8.25% return over the next 25 years may or may not be achievable. And of course, the real scary part is if the average return over time falls below whatever you would be able to purchase a pension bond at, would be very, very scary. But the investment people tell us that if that happened, this whole system would be so, I mean, the impact on the system would be so scary. I mean, it's real, that would be kind of
collapse.
Yeah, that would be collapse. This may or may not be a good option for all municipalities, may or may not be a good option for the state, but it's certainly one that seems worthy of exploration.
Well, and you, I just want to reiterate so that everybody knows exactly what that past service offset account is we're looking at the calculated amount of that would be $2.681 billion. It would have to be deposited today in an account, and that would be state money. Now, the difference is that 2.68 is we're looking at that projection at 8.25% to pay that unfunded liability. But if you did a pension bond, you'd only be looking at the difference between the 8.25 and what you had to pay for. So, I mean, you don't use the principal of it. This uses the principal.
Right.
So, you know, we can ask for a calculation on that, but I would imagine if you're only talking about, 3% interest on an amount of money instead of having the amount of money and 8.25%, you're probably talking, we'd probably have to borrow $15 billion, to do that as a pension bond to make those payments. Now, those payments aren't all the same, and I don't know, there's people shaking their heads out here, so we can find out what somebody that knows more about it than I am, because I'm not an actuarial. But I just know that there's a lot of difference between 8.25 and 3%, and there's a lot of difference between being using up the principal amount or having to return the principal amount at the end of the time. So, but I appreciate that, and we'll take a look at that and make those and see if we can get some calculations made. Kevin.
And Mr. Chairman, I am so far from a financial wizard, actuary, or banker that it's astounding. But the possibility exists of maybe partially significantly reducing some of the liability. And I also, as a very final thing, I should obviously mention this, is you're looking to the finances of school districts and communities and the university and the state for the future is very, very much appreciated. The work you're doing on creating a new tier really doesn't have any impact on the current problem as far as the liability goes, as you know. What you've suggested really does have a very significant impact on the problem as it currently sits today. Pension bonds may have an impact on the problem as it sits today, and I want to thank you very much for taking a look at that system or that issue as well. And we are at your disposal. We are employers. We care deeply about our employees. We care deeply about our tax rates and our finances. And we're at your disposal at the table or anywhere else anytime, and we will continue commenting. So thank you very much.
Okay, and I appreciate you. I appreciate everybody coming in here today and be online because, like I say, the Capitol is a ghost town today. I mean, everybody's gone except for a few of us and people that, you know, are listening online or will catch us on Gavel Gavel. And I hope people remember that as things come up and they have questions, they can go back and listen on Gavel to Gavel through the State of Alaska website basis. And also, I don't know, it'll probably be played on Gavel to Gavel here over the intervening time because there's not much else happening here at the Capitol. So thanks, Kevin. Appreciate that. Is there anybody else that would like to come give us some ideas on this? Come on forward. Don't be bashful. Remember, this isn't a formal hearing or anything else. This is an idea time. We're talking about these things and trying to get ideas so that we can come forward with the best product. Morning.
Good morning, Senator. Representative Seaton, Tom Harvey, Executive Director of NEA Alaska. I have a question first, but it points to a question asked by Representative Gatto and several parts of the presentation that you've made. And I think it's very clear to everybody that it's the assumptions that we make that ultimately produces past service costs, the normal cost rate, the actuarial cost rate, and that the problem here is what are the assumptions we need to make, and then how do we adjust for those assumptions in the future if the assumptions are wrong. So the first question I would ask that also sort of comes from Kevin Ritchie's comment. What is the assumption around the growth rate of compensation of employees, since it is the percentage of their compensation that is the real basis for this whole change? So what is the assumption that has been made as to what the salary increases or compensation increases are going to be?
Are you referring to steps and columns that are already built into the increases?
No, sir. I'm referring to what the assumption is by the actuary as to what the increases are going to be, because that's part of the basis of determining what the normal cost rate and, in fact, past service cost may, in fact, be a factor to the past service cost liability.
Right.
I can explain that in a moment if you'd like.
And, you know, what I've got right here is all of these scenarios had a 1% population growth. Okay, there's two different factors.
Mm-hmm.
One is how many employees are we going to have? That's the population growth is 1% population growth. All of these tables are calculated on that. I'm trying to remember. It's in one of the Mercer details, and I just can't remember what the... So just Katie, do you have that? Katie Schaus is my staffer that's been working night and day on this bill, and we'll see if we can figure that out, what that is. So we'll get that and get back to you, and so everybody will know what that is. Go ahead, Tom.
And Representative Seaton, I neglected to say right up front, we really appreciate the work that you and your staff have been doing and how open you have been about the process. And I think that if people understand that what you're trying to do is create something better, that will help with in terms of some of the emotion that is here on this issue. It is very clear that when you, in the past, when the state has made changes to the tier systems, that those changes have been changes to a system that makes it not as attractive as the previous tier system was. If I could draw from your presentation this morning, What you are attempting to do is create a tier system that is more attractive than the present Tier 2 and Tier 3 system, and therefore folks would want to move to this system. And if you got them to move from this system to this system, then in fact the past service liability would go down because they wouldn't be sitting over in Tier 2 or Tier 3 where there is a defined benefit part in relation to health costs. And that's really what is the driving mechanism, I believe, in the presentation. And so I want to explain a little bit more about the salary piece. I have not seen the data on the assumptions, but if the assumptions have been based on a 4% increase in compensation of employees over the past two decades, and in fact the legislature hasn't been and local effort, I'll put both of those on the table, haven't been such that 4% increases, and in fact they haven't been happening, then one of the major factors to the past service cost is the fact that we haven't been providing enough funding in order to provide for those compensation levels that are assumed in the actuary to be reached at the collective bargaining table. And I think that now becomes a new factor that we all best look at in terms of when we make decisions in this legislature, how does that impact? Do we have an unintended consequence on the other side of the issue? The reason I raised that is I did some scenarios at the request of some folks. And when I did those scenarios, I assumed a 2.6% increase in salary. And when I did those scenarios, based on these bills, the reality is that somebody making $27,000 can't afford retiring under this plan. I'll be glad to share that information with you to show you the assumptions made when those tables were created. And I think that is part of what we really need to get down to, is how do we get to a set of assumptions that we all believe are realistic all will achieve towards in the future. In terms of the composition of the boards, I think you've made this comment previously, and I would urge you to follow up on it. I do believe you ought to have either some present PERS, TERS board members in, or I would suggest that you may want to get a couple of recent past board members, since present board members, at least in the TERS system, and are up for appointment on a regular basis, and if they are presenting information that may not be exactly friendly to what has been presented to date, they may be putting their appointments in jeopardy. And so I would suggest that you look at a couple of immediate past people. I would suggest Jerry Patterson, who is here in Juneau, an immediate past member of the TERS board. Charlie Arriaga, immediate past member and chairman of the TERS board, who is from Ketchikan. And I'm sure both of them would be able to make themselves available to your committee.
And just so you know, I think that we did invite members of the boards.
We will
for the next hearing make sure that we invite them. We were talking about making sure we invited ASPIVO as well, because you know, these are internal workings that we don't have much knowledge of. We're up here trying to create the system, and so we're trying to get all the help we can from employers, employees, boards, everybody else.
I appreciate that, sir. Another piece of what I hope is correct, and for clarity and to lessen the emotion, so to speak, the past service costs that you have been talking about will be the same with or without a new tier system. What will be different is the future normal cost rates. But even if we did not have a new tier system in place, all of the past service costs that we've presently calculated would still have to be calculated into the system. I think that is a misnomer that some folks have, creating this new tier system creates a past service cost, or not creating it wouldn't have as much past service cost.
Right, and I'd like to just clarify that if people will look on their on these tables, you'll see that there's a total over there, and that is if we have a new Tier 4 system and breaks it down of what's happening in Tier 4 or Tier 3 in TERS. But that's because those are new employees coming on in the system. And if you turn over to the next page, you'll see the number of employees and how they project the employee replacement and why in later years Tier 4 is much higher is because you're almost all the employee base over after that 25 years is based on Tier 4 employees. But these payments are based on the calculations that are over at the other side, which is projected salaries, total projected salaries. So it doesn't matter if a new employee comes in Tier 2 or Tier 3, TERS or Tier 3 or Tier 4, or defined benefit, defined contribution plan, the past service cost amortization is based on the total salary base. And there's been a lot of misunderstanding on that. People thought that you can wave a wand and say, okay, now it's a DC plan, now we don't have to collect any past service costs. Well, the past service cost in those employer graphs is still paid on the entire wage base, no matter what plan they're in. And so I'm glad you brought that out, because that's really critical for everybody to understand that the past service cost is identical if you are under a DC plan or the current defined benefit plan. And appreciate you pointing that out.
In regards to the time in which you can retire, if I start my career at 30 years old, under the present proposal, I work for 30 years, then I can retire directly from the system, and I can get 90% of my health care costs paid for through this fund. But if I'm a normal individual and I graduate from college, and I know my statement of me being normal, Representative Gatto would take some humor in. If an individual graduates at 22 and begins their teaching career at 22 or 23, what you're in fact saying is that they've got to teach for 38 years. And because they have to retire directly from the system to be able to get health care costs partially paid for by the system. So that means that we're asking people to put a 38-year career in the classroom. And I would suggest to you that that's a very rare person indeed who can survive the rigors of the classroom for 38 years. And I think that's one of the issues that people don't pay attention to enough, is how rigorous the teaching world is today. And in fact, how rigorous the public school world is, not just for the teachers, but for everybody else who's in that school. All you have to consider is the safety issues and the fear that is in people's minds as they go to work, and how that plays on them in terms of the stress of the day. And so I would suggest that we have to look at that component, because what I fear occurs is another thing, just to put it in strict labor management term. I am now in my 34th year. I'm only 56 years old, but I'm in my 34th year, and in 34 years, I'm sure there are some folks that think I've done some things correctly, lots of folks, but there are a few folks that may think I've done some things wrong. And for whatever reason, somebody decides I need to be terminated. And for whatever reason, to the due process system, I am terminated. After 34 years, I can't access my retirement, my health care portion, because I haven't retired directly out of the system. I think that's a problem.
That's a good point. And I sure appreciate you bringing it up, because this is what we want to look at in these work drafts. That's what it's for.
In terms of the portability, I would be remiss if I didn't say the same thing here as I said in Senate Finance on SB 141. Portability in most professions is a good thing. In the education profession, I'm not so sure portability is the best idea, because what it suggests is that we can have teachers continue, the workforce continually move. And I think research tells us that stability of the faculty in a particular school is a major factor in student achievement. It is